96 Degrees from the City, a podcast about writing and Western Sydney. I'm your host, Fiona Wright, and I'm delighted to be talking in this episode to the novelist and essayist Luke Carman. Luke's collection of stories, An Elegant Young Man, won the 2015 New South Wales Premier's Prize for New Writing and was shortlisted for the ALS Gold Medal and Queensland Premier's Prize for Short Fiction. It also saw him named one of the Sydney Morning Herald Young Novelists of the Year in 2014. His essays have been published in Meanjin and in the Sydney Review of Books. Luke lives in Mount Pritchard, near Liverpool, and almost all of his works are set at least in part in this suburb. He joined me to talk about self-effacement and shame, the strange public nature of publishing, and his affinity for the writer Gerald Manane. Here's Luke reading from his recent essay, A Northern Rivers Romance.
It was an email from Alice, the editor at my publisher's office just up the hall from my own shabby desk, that led me back to Byron Bay. Alice wrote, "Well, you tried to get out of the festival circuit, but they want you anyway." Attached was an invitation signed from the director of the Byron Bay Writers' Festival. Her letter read, It gives me great pleasure to invite you to participate in our 2016 program. For the last 2 years, we have had some extra funding to run a 5-writers regional tour in the lead up to the main festival. We put 5 writers in a van and send them to 5 regional towns in the Northern Rivers in 5 days. Reading that first cordial offering, innocent as it sounds reproduced here, I saw the makings of a trap. It is difficult for me to explain the process that led to this suspicion, so I'll stick to the associations and abstractions that occurred as I imagine what attending this affair might entail. Admittedly, from a distance, to anyone unfamiliar with the insider baseball of the writing world, the opportunity to be flown, feted, and paid to partake in a festival on the northern east coast of New South Wales might sound like a gift horse, so to speak. But there was doubt in my heart. For one thing, the timing was dubious. The email in question had arrived in the aftermath of an editorial I'd written on the devilish nature of the writing culture, with particular contempt for the hubbub of festivals and their sinister rituals. Power plays in the so-called scene had come into my little office in Bankstown to assure me that blacklistings had been put in place to keep precisely these kind of offers and invites permanently off the table. Were these power players mistaken? They'd seemed so self-assured. To make matters more suspect, there was the fact that I had no new book to shill, my own slim square volume having long ago exhausted whatever modest readership it had managed to propagate. There was something in Alice's tone, too, that struck me as a clear and present warning, a subtle but unmistakable imploring note of concern. Perhaps it was just her way of implying that I should not screw things up further than I already had with the industry, make some friends for a change and stay off whatever high horse I might be tempted to ride. But one can never be too careful when reading between the lines. The sort of thoughts I'm describing here are paranoid fantasies. If I could have seen that at the time, sitting at my desk, deliberating on the offer as the little delusions began to sprout, it might not have made much difference. To weed out what was at stake in the director's invitation, I began to imagine the landscape of Byron Bay, so as to rehearse in advance the pitfalls awaiting. For a setting, the vague image of a beach somewhere, a bright sun and a long curving beach populated by tourists in shorts and thongs, the air stinking of seaweed and sunscreen, a hot burning sensation spread across my cheeks and sand between my toes. High to the right, I saw a limestone lighthouse on a hill and seagulls rising to a background of clouds. This seemed a suitable conception of a beachside paradiso, one likely to fit some part of the bay's picture. A memory invented in this idyll. I remembered what it should not be possible to forget. For a while, at least, I was a married man and had honeymooned deep in the forests of the riverlands of northern New South Wales, stopping and staying in Byron on the way there. Memories of our drive along the eastern coast of the country as they recurred to me, and as I replay them again now, seem so estranged as to be the makings of a dream. The actors in these scenes look unfamiliar. They move in a watery motion that does not conform to the wooden clumsiness of recent years. Their details are half hidden in the gaps in shade. Is it nostalgia that makes them look so nimble and light, or some other error of translation. It was in this dreamy unreality of the past that my wife and I stayed in a treetop cabin resort off a dirt track which wound between the trees of Mullumbimby, with the sounds of strange birds rousing us in the morning and a fine gold light glowing in the room above the bed. An alternate version of myself pulls back the blinds on the way to the bathroom, half-dressed, and sits on the cold slate toilet across from tall glass windows open to the dense forest outside the cabin. This stranger appears, in my recollections, to be watching the high-top trees flicker in green and gold sweat while rare feathers sweep between the branches, knocking seed pods through the long leaves. It is impossible to intuit what this thin young man is thinking. His hair looks great, or at least there's more of it. And when night comes, armed with flimsy eco-friendly torches and by careful footsteps on mossy rock, the couple creep to a shallow riverbed splattered with iridescent oozing of a glowworm colony clinging to the earth above the water. The wife, her long hair invisible in the dark, smiles to discover that her thin husband believes the worms to be living creatures. "It's just a conspiracy of impressions," she says to the stranger, in a voice swallowed up by the damp echoing forest. The moon comes out loud above them and the wife strips down to climb onto a fallen tree bridging the riverbanks. He cautions her not to go out so far above the water, but she laughs and her skin in the pale light looks like a mirage in the night woods. It's perhaps because of the illusions of body and landscape that he does not react when the log first shakes and twists under her weight. The image of her out on a dead tree, naked as a forest nymph, with her strong hands holding her high above the flowing waters as she slides along the grainy length between the banks, forces me, at this moment, watching and recalling the pair as they play their game by the river, to wonder if there is any truth at all to this series of recollections. Who was this thin man and his lady of Shalott? The body forgets itself in a rather final way. Most nights, the world is very quiet, and the bed feels to my ever-thickening body like an examination table for the gods. Books pile up on the bedside, but there's nothing much to be found in those. Just strangers in a sunken carriage. The doubt of memory runs so deep that I'm compelled into the dark side of this room I'm writing in to look through the drawer by the bed and find, sandwiched between court summons and speeding fines, a little black case containing a wedding band. I am required to run my finger inside the rim to feel the inscription which reads, "Ma amas tan sind." It means, "I love you," in a rare Antipodean language. The words, etched in white gold, help to hold the disparate dimensions together, but the ring must go back into its tiny leather snare, and I have to step away from the bed. Certainty climbs into a bed of fog and fades under its covers. Who is it, after all? At this table in a room in a house on a hill, who is taking this strange tone of voice, who goes about believing the inscriptions inside a ring or the impressions of images all lined up in a row like stitching of feathers in a mycenaean crown on the dry skull of an old chieftain alone in his honeycomb tomb. And for what it is worth, I recall that my new wife screamed when she fell into the river, and her knees were bleeding when we limped back to the room to pull the leeches from her wet body, with mud and blood in the bed sheets that night of our honeymoon.
I'm so glad you read that piece.
Oh, thank you. I didn't hate it, reading it back again, you know. It was good.
It's a great start. No, but I love it because I think it's such an interesting piece technically, right, that all of that first section is kind of set in an office or a bedroom in the suburbs, but you kind of draw on all these dreams and memories and speculation, all those paranoid fantasies, as you call them. That, and the whole piece works like that, just kind of this weaving together of different times and places.
Yeah, that was the real trick of that, of writing that essay, and it was in some ways the whole point of doing it. I found that it's an interesting thing. I think this will relate in some ways to discussion of Gerald Manane as well, but I find that there's a really strong limitation to my imagination, or maybe it's not necessarily a limitation, but it's something obsessive maybe in my imagination, and I always come back to as a starting point, the room that I grew up in when I tried to begin a narrative internally. You know, when I'm sitting down or when I'm taking a walk and I'm thinking, what's this narrative going to be? How do I begin to tell this story, say, of going to Byron Bay for a week and meeting all these different authors and being in front of people every single day and sort of performing the persona of a writer and seeing how other people do it and balancing all these different concerns and my own affinity, you know, very limited affinity, I suppose, with Byron Bay itself. And how do I get all this across? And so I did what I always do, which I generally consider to be a fiction approach to things, a fictional approach to things, is I start to draw some images together. And I don't exactly know how it happens, but, you know, I've read a lot about it from other writers, but you have this fictional series of images and they somehow take a shape in grammatical form on the page. Or if you like, sometimes you speak them out loud or you think them aloud, so to speak.
It's funny to me that it just struck me then that's a narrative, a fictional device to you, because it sounds like a really poetic way of thinking to me. That I always think that poetry is about drawing images or sounds together and then just leaving them to resonate.
Okay, well that's really interesting, because I consider myself to be a fiction writer, but I would love to be a poet. You know, I don't know what I mean.
Don't hear that.
Well, I'm always jealous of poets. Let's put it that way. I always think, you know, God, I know poetry is more technically demanding, or at least that's what I suspect it to be.
Mm.
And my attempts to write poetry have proven that whatever technical expertise is required, I am lacking. But I often think, God, I desperately wish I had the freedom, whatever it is that I perceive that poets have, that just lets them take images, make shapes in the most pure way. And I don't know if it's pure, but that's the way it appears to me.
Do you mean in the sense you don't have to then go somewhere with it?
Yeah.
Okay, I see what you mean.
For instance, this... The essay, the Byron Bay essay, the Northern Rivers Romance that we started talking about, in some ways, I know that novel, for instance, can pretty much do anything you need.
Yeah.
And short stories, you know, to a lesser extent, can also do the same thing. And in essays, you can use whatever you want. You know, I can't remember who said it, but one definition I came across of what an essay is, it's a form in which you are obliged to use every available resource. That's the way I think of essays. But at the same time, there's a weird tension for me when I'm writing an essay where I'll be doing something and I think, is this essay what I'm attempting to do now?
Yeah.
Or has it gone way off course? I read an essay a little while ago and I can't remember anything about it except that it was written by Caesar Aria, and it was, the other thing I remember about it, I suppose, is that it was completely insane. It just seemed to go everywhere, and it leapt from one image to another. It sort of went on these bizarre tangents. It changed grammatically halfway through. I have no idea how I would find it again other than just Googling his name and searching through all his essays. But I took that as this often, but, you know, I see somebody else had done it and I thought, shit, well, I can do that too. That's what I want to do. But I still feel like I'm walking, a tightrope, and I suppose everybody is whenever they write in terms of, you know, failing in the face of the form or whatever, or by the mandates of the form. But I was thinking, God, as I was writing that essay, the Northern Rivers one, I had no idea whether what I was doing was just hoarding words together and being completely what people call pretentious, you know? So I was very nervous about it. And I sent it away and I got a phone call from Ivor a little while later, because he'd seen the draft. And he said, listen, I'm just calling you to talk to you about that essay that you wrote. And I remember I was sitting in the, what's that pub in Newtown? It's on Australia Street.
Oh, the courthouse.
Yeah, I was in the courthouse. I was sitting outside in the courthouse. I was drinking a beer.
It's so funny, the number of times Ivor's called me and I've been in the courthouse. He's like, are you at the pub again? And I'm like, yeah. So.
Exactly, you know. I was sitting there, I'm by myself, just drinking a beer for no reason. In the middle of the day, I get a call. He's like, I called him to talk to you about that essay. And I fully expected him to just say, you know, that's a real piece of shit. You know? What was that? You know, that's not an essay. But he said, oh, no, it's good. And so I was like, oh, thank God. It's like it worked. You know, and I'm sorry to go on this long ramble about it, but that you started by talking about the technical aspects of it, and I was like, shit, I did it.
Yeah.
It worked. And so it's – in some ways I think it's for whatever that's, this is worth, it's probably the only thing I can think of that I've ever written that I still feel pretty good about. Afterwards,
yeah.
You know? It doesn't bring me any shame, let's put it that way. Not much shame, anyway.
It's interesting that you should use that word, because I was obviously going to ask you about shame. Because one of the things that I noticed a lot in your work, and I think that it kind of crops up a little bit in that essay when you talk about, you know, your slim square volume having long ago exhausted its modest readership. But there always seems to be these movements of kind of undercutting things that are going on. And sometimes, like in An Elegant Young Man a lot, it's kind of, I don't know, don't trust me, I could just be talking shit here. These, where your narrator kind of steps back and sort of says, don't know. But then also often it's these kind of gestures towards big myths about what sort of writer or what writing life is supposed to be, and then cutting them back down again. You know, either of course they butt up against the suburban and like the banality of that small room and the examination table bed, or they just say, I don't know, this could just be a delusion, this is just paranoia. But I think it's a really interesting, that tension in your work to kind of gesture out to these big things and then just go, nah.
Yeah, what?
Yeah, nah.
Yeah, it's the theme of everything I write in some ways. And, you know, as absurd as it sounds, as you know, I did my doctorate on the subject of shame in relation to Australian literature. And I think in a lot of ways it's a classically, canonically Australian approach to literature, is to be, you know, and it's not quite the same thing as a cultural cringe, but it's related, and it's, you know, an uncertainty
yeah.
about the project of literature in the first place. You know, how do you begin? And, you know, I know, like, I think of some great, popular novels, let's say Eucalyptus, which begins, to me, it's always funny that Eucalyptus begins with this long, encyclopedic introduction to native flora. You know, it's like, and it's going into it, you know, essentially it's going into this love story.
Yeah.
But it has to begin with this really analytical, clinical, you know, throat clearing in order to get into intimacy, you know, and I think that's, for me, is a great example of how Australian literature works. You know, you sort of got to fend off these imaginary accusations before you even get started, you know, or this, you know, kind of baroque internal critic always hanging around the corner, or, you know, leering
kind of
at
saying, why are you even doing this?
Yeah. And it's like, I think I've changed my mind a lot about how shame works in Australian culture, and I go back and forth. And once I completed my doctorate, I pushed all that aside in my mind, and I don't have anything articulate to say about it anymore. I'd need to go back and look at my thesis in order to remember what I thought about it when I did think about it, but. I know it's there, and it's also been it was actually a big obstacle to getting started when I was young and I was writing, because it was just an immovable object in the middle of everything I wrote. And my editor early on, Ivor Indick, when you and I were first starting out, way back when, say in 2007, we had that writing group, and there was a point where I'd been coming for about a year, and Ivor eventually said to me, "Look, you're not getting it. You're always aborting the story, only moments after getting into it," and that was. And his argument was that it was out of a kind of shame, you know, like I was attempting to make these, as you say, like the big gestures, and then just out of absolute embarrassment, just bailing on it and tearing the narrative apart and never developing anything. And he was trying to explain this to me week in, week out, and eventually he just said, "Look, you're not getting it. I think it's best if you don't come back anymore." Wow. And so I really panicked. And, I really tried to understand what he meant. And I saw that, you know, structurally, how shame was working in my writing. Mm. I mean, it was that shame is the incomplete withdrawal of attention. That's, I think, one way of talking about shame. And what was happening was sensing my exposure in the text, whenever anything starts to develop, I would, and, you know, rationalizing it by saying I'm trying to be experimental with structure, I would just tear everything to pieces and I would just sink out of it and I'd say, "Oh, well,
doesn't matter anyway.
It doesn't matter anyway. And, who cares about stories?" Yeah. You know, and so it was a really hard thing to overcome at the beginning.
No, it's interesting because writing is such an exposing thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, like... when you publish, you're putting something out in public. That's the nature of it.
Yes, yeah. That took a long time to get used to too. Yeah. I mean, I know we've both talked about this before, but publishing is, you know, it's literally about making something public, as you say. And most writers, you know, emerging, training, young writers... I don't think they think about that. It's just a goal. It's just what you are meant to do as a writer. But you never talk about that when you are in training, so to speak, or an apprentice writer. You don't even think about what happens afterwards. And I know...
Because you can't, in a way, can you? I sort of, like, because you've never done it before, you don't have a way of conceptualizing it.
Yeah, that's right. And even after you've done it, you know, like, you're really not sure what's happening, you know? Or what's happening to you, when my collection Elegant Young Man came out, it virtually sent me around the bend. I went out and I completely lost my mind. I'm not sure how much of it was due to the book, but I remember there were points where I was, you know, calling up my editor saying, "Oh, this was, you know, been a terrible mistake." And he was saying to me, "Well, you know, relax. He kept saying to me, "Look, it's not like it's meteoric, you know, like you've sold like 2,000 copies." And he was right. But to me, I swear, it never occurred to me that anyone would have it and read it.
Yeah.
It was just going to go on to the Girimondo label and sit it in an office somewhere. That's where my concept of it was, you know?
This is where my ambitions lie.
Exactly. You know, and I'm not bragging when I say it, but, you know, the fact that your face ends up in a paper or that you're on a panel or whatever was just absolutely unbelievable to me, and I was no way prepared for it. And my psyche, which is obviously pretty frail, went down the gurgler immediately. And in some ways, that's why I've really enjoyed coming to the essay form, because it's been a way to deal with the fallout from the minor fallout from the minor attention the book got, you know? And that's one of the big themes I'm hoping to look at now.
Yeah, well, I definitely don't think you're alone in that, though. I know a lot of people who... It's an adjustment, you know, when something comes out and there's kind of response that you're not expecting. You know, I don't think I'd say I lost my mind after Small Acts, but, like, it took a good year for me to, like, wrap my head around what was happening and what to do next.
Oh,
and
it must have been.
It was, yeah, and I think the weird thing with that too was that, you know, I wasn't expecting it to do anything at all. And, I mean, like, the book's about disappearance, right?
Yeah.
And then, like, suddenly makes you much more visible in the world. Yeah. I was like, oh, I don't know what to do about this.
Well, I just, you know, I love the story where it's suddenly it's on the Stella shortlist.
Yeah.
And you're scooped up as part of the Stella tour, and you're going and speaking to all these people, and people in the crowd are holding your book, and, you know, it's got your face on it.
Yeah, right. It's just like staring back at me.
I mean, that's the ultimate festival panel scenario. Yeah. I that is just so surreal. And as you say, it's like, well, you don't realize when you're writing it that essentially you're asking for it. Like you're, you know, it's not like you want it, but it's you're daring it to happen in some ways, you know, because you're selling this intimate thing, you know. I know it's crude to talk about it like that, but it's your consciousness in some way, like, or at least you're responsible for it.
Yeah.
And it becomes very, very easy to confuse the two, confuse your own thinking and what you've written and who you are on the page or what the page represents of you, you know. And
do you think that's sort of especially the case when, like you know, a lot of Elegant Young Men was drawn from your world and your life and the places that you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was... You know, in a technical sense, like as a writer, I was aware of what I was doing, but I didn't understand the what it would be like to have that reflected back.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, the narrator has my name and all that sort of thing, but I was doing that deliberately, thinking that this is it creates an interesting technical tension, and you know, it's again. To bring up, Gerald Benane, it was, you know, this is a kind of Gerald Benane thing. And it's an extremely old technique.
Yeah.
To give, you know, I think it's as old as Balzac or whatever, you know, you use your name as a fictional version of yourself, like kind of an avatar or whatever. And, but, you know, it's, you know, I have people speaking to me about it as if it's an unusual thing to do. You know, they say, you call your character, you gave your character your own name.
Yeah.
And so it's a whole mix of different reactions you get. Like, one is that people are like, well, it's autobiographical. And then other people say, well, it's, they look at it from a technical point of view. But it doesn't matter ultimately. Like, it's all sort of, it's all your responsibility and
what people... But at the same time, you can't control that.
Exactly. You have no control over it. And it has an effect, and it's very difficult to work out what the effect is, even when you're in the middle of it. And I know that, and it's also like, now what? Like, I still want to keep writing, and I had an idea before I wrote the Anagin. I mean, this is the direction I want to go, and this is the kind of writing I'm interested in, and so on. And one thing, you know, I didn't really think about was that once you start going down this path, in some ways there is no turning back. Like, I've picked this approach and I've just, it sucked me in, and there's no way to turn back and do things differently.
Because you feel skilled in that, or?
Well, yeah, it's just.
Because you think it's expected?
Not because it's expected. It's just that's, it's more it's not skill. It's like a habit. It's habitual.
Right. Oh, you know? Okay.
I'm sort of calcified around me. I can't. It's like I was saying at the beginning with that essay. Like I say, how do I begin? Well, I begin the same way I always do.
Yeah.
It begin at the beginning in back in my room, back in my home, back in Mount Pritchard, and to do otherwise now would basically require me to force it like this huge, like it'd be like excising part of my mind, you know.
That's interesting. I like that, you know. To go back to like beginning in that room and heading out, one of the things I find really interesting about that though is what it does to the suburb too, that it brings it into contact with all these different places and all these different ideas and different worlds. That kind of reminds me a bit of what Jennifer Maiden does, like her TVs, you know, in the George Jeffries series is always, you know, that they're in a room in Penrith, but on the TV there's, you know, George Bush or Iraq or
you know,
a Brazilian slum in one of them. I feel like it's such an interesting dynamic.
Yeah. I love the way Maiden does that. It's a very strange way to think about it, but I often think about, you know, the persona or whatever in Jennifer Maiden's work is sort of like kind of oracular sitting over like this crystal ball. Exactly, you know, and sort of seeing and sort of, you know, astral traveling out into the world and seeing these things. And because she has all the, and it doesn't prevent her being in the house in Penrith, it doesn't prevent her from walking down the street with Christopher Brennan or whatever, you know, and shaking hands with Paul Keating or something like that, or, you know, Donald Rumsfeld or something. And I love that. And it's the way my imagination, I think, is geared as well. Like I have to go from the local, the original, in order to get anywhere else. And I can't, in a weird way, I can't think about anywhere else without starting there.
Might be a good point to ask you about Mount Pritchard. Tell me about Mount Pritchard.
Wow. Okay. Mount Pritchard is where I grew up. It's a suburb on the outskirts of Liverpool. And it's a mountain. I call it a mountain. Well, you know, there's probably some technical reason why it's not, but if you stand at the end of my house and look out the window, you can see all the way to Sydney. You can see Centre Point. I think you used to be able to see the Harbour Bridge. All the trees were in the way, though. but it's a long, I'm trying to cut them down. But anyway, it's a long way away from the city, but I can see it from there.
Yeah.
I can see the heart of the city from my suburb. And growing up, I never thought of myself as anything other than a denizen of Sydney.
Yeah.
It wasn't until a long time later that I became aware that there is a separation in most people's minds, and that there are people, for instance, who think that Sydney ends at Leichhardt, say, or whatever.
Yeah, I was at a pub in Marrickville a few weeks ago, and there was a guy there who was coked off his face, but that's a different story, who gave me this big lecture at the bar about how he doesn't normally come this far west. and I was like, dude, you're in Marrickville.
Yeah, it's amazing that I can't relate to that attitude, obviously, but it's amazing they persist even now. And so, you know, that's part of it for me as a writer. But and you and I, you know, I consider your book to be the first of, you know, I know you've heard me say this before, but I consider your first collection, Knuckle, to be the beginning of a kind of Westie push, if you like.
But it's what we were all doing.
We were all part of the one group and we're all doing it. And, you know, we weren't the first Western Sydney people to write. You know, that's not at all the case. But, you know, it was a new group and it was a new kind of energy. And
you had the support of a publisher too, which...
Yeah, absolutely. Like Gerimondo, you know, published pretty much everyone in that group. But, you know, it was sort of nascent.
Yeah.
And in order to get it going, you had to come at it with or at least the publishers felt they had to come at it like, this is Western Sydney literature. And so you would end up talking about Western Sydney a lot and being, you know, and boring the shit out of people, you know. Like, you know, you'd read reviews of certain books and they start with
so-and-so is from Western Sydney.
Yeah, and demographics.
Yeah.
There are 2 million people estimated to live in Western Sydney by 2018 or whatever. It's like, who gives a shit about all this stuff? Why are we talking about it? But it was necessary at the time, or at least it seemed that way, to the people who were doing things.
Hmm.
It's in danger of becoming, of collapsing in on itself.
Yeah.
You know, this all, you know, it's, and I don't like a lot of what's sort of the ancillary or the effect of that being somewhat successful, that movement is, you know, the creation of a kind of Western Sydney territory, which is completely hermetic.
Yeah.
And, you know, absolutely unique and interesting. Every bit of it is interesting in its own right and deserves to be, you know, sort of have every aspect of it, you know, communicated to every Australian reader. You know, it's not that different. It's not that unique that there's an actual boundary around it, you know.
Yeah.
But I see that kind of attitude. I know I'm talking very abstract about it, but I see that kind of attitude even with other parts of the country. It's like, well, when I wrote the Northern Rivers romance, it came out and very stupidly, I should never ever do it, and I try not to do it, but I went on to the Twitter feed of Sydney Review of Books to see, like, did anyone read this shit or what? And so I went on there, and one of the very first comments was by someone saying, keep your grubby hands off my childhood. And then, what the hell? The fuck is this person talking about? And then I had a closer look, and they were from the Northern Rivers.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the hell? This has nothing to do with your childhood. What are you talking about?
Never read the comments.
I screwed up. I screwed up big. I think that to me is a really weird attitude, or a really weird way of thinking about literature, that, you know, it's territorial.
Yeah, yeah.
To that extent, you know.
But that's what I mean about your stuff too. It's that if you're starting from this place and then heading out and bringing all these other places in, then surely that's the very opposite of territorial.
Yeah, well, you would.
That kind of blending and.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I can't see how there's any point, like, you know, small acts of disappearance you know, your essay collection or, you know, Lachlan Brown's Limited Cities. I mean, both of those collections are, you know, they're globetrotting. They go everywhere. And the subjectivity is the thing which is rooted in a place and so on. But if there's a territorial limitation to that subjectivity, then I can understand someone saying, look, you are the product of this particular subject. You are this particular subjectivity. Therefore your imagination has its limits. You can't possibly imagine what it's like to be me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fair enough. I can understand that argument, but, if there's no point in taking your subjectivity somewhere else, or, you know, crossing boundaries, then there's really no point in writing anything down in the first place, because what's the point of sharing? What's the point of externalizing language at all if we're not trying to cross those kind of boundaries? If you're not trying to go from one place to another, or, you know, I just don't see what the point of literature, of fiction, of poetry is if it's not
if
about...
you're going to stay in one place.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, it's just, you know, this all diary.
Yeah.
I think. Anyway.
To change tack a little bit, I wanted to ask you about humour as well, because I think your work's really funny. Another young man was funny. That the Northern Rivers essay I find really funny because of the big kind of leaps of exaggeration and the kind of gentle ribbing of the other writers that are on the bus.
I told a lie a moment ago. When I went on to the Twitter thing and I was looking at the reaction to the Northern Rivers romance, I did see a couple of other tweets before I bailed out, and one of them was, why is this guy being so mean to the other writers?
Oh.
And, you know, like, I understand where that's coming from, but that's how I became very close very quickly, which I didn't expect, with the other writers that I mentioned in that essay. And
when you described it to me as five people on a bus for 5 days, my immediate reaction was like, oh, hell no.
I couldn't think of anything stupider for me to do than to place myself in that situation. I thought it was going to be an absolute nightmare, and I wasn't going to be able to handle anybody, and they were going to look at me with contempt as this screwball jerk that somebody invited on this, this fantastic literary tour, and all the audience. Anyway, I loved them all. They were great. And I became, friends with them. And that's what you do with friends. You take the piss out of them, you know? I can't. You know, what the hell? It's in terms of sense of humour, I think that there is an... I have a very Australian sense of humour, I think. Very, kind of dry a little sarcastic. And
that's the word I was just about to use.
Yeah. And I cannot take anything too seriously for too long.
Yeah.
Or that feeling of shame will creep on in, And, I remember, I think it was in John Hurst's The Australians, his book on Australian culture, where he said that Australians, that taking the piss out of things is just an Australian way of life, and that's the way it is. And although our jokes can sometimes seem incredibly racist and sexist and homophobic or whatever, it's just our way. And, and I think there's...
When was that written, do you know?
Think it was... No, it was at least 10 years ago. I'm pretty sure it might have come out in like 2005 or somewhere thereabouts. Mm. And so I know that, it can be used to justify a whole lot of things, this idea of the Australian sense of humour and, taking the piss out of everything. But I got to point out, with what John Hurst was saying, that's fine, but we've got to be able to laugh at ourselves, which I think a lot of time we suck at it. We are so sensitive, so thin-skinned. It's very hard for us to...
You mean people in general or writers or...
Yeah, like I think, the idea... I think that's why Australian writing is sometimes considered to be humourless.
Right.
If you're going to go into it, you have to go all out and be as serious as you possibly can be, because you're completely isolated from the general culture anyway.
Yeah.
That's the idea. But I don't know. I think our sense of humour... I remember hearing Nick Cave in an interview describe our sense of humour as we don't really know whether we're joking or not at a certain point. And that's how I think of it, is I don't know whether I'm making fun of things or not half the time.
Yeah.
That gives you a certain it's permissive to think that way, I think you can get away with things in terms of style you were talking before about grandiose element, and that's why I love people like Thomas Bernhardt.
Yeah.
Obviously he's not Australian, but I read his books laughing all the way through, and it's because they're so ridiculous. And the same with Dostoevsky. Like, Dostoevsky is one of my favorite writers. And I think I remember reading Nabokov saying about Dostoevsky, who, you know, he claimed to despise, that the only redeeming quality he had was his unintentional ridiculousness. But I think it's funny on purpose. It's silly. It's farcical. But I think a lot of that comes out of self-consciousness. You know, you make fun of things because you're self-aware.
Yeah.
And it eases the pain. And it's an old comedian's trick is, you know, like if there's something wrong with you, you've got to make fun of it as soon as you get on stage. Does. Yeah, exactly. You've got to get in. You've got to get in before the punch, so to speak. So I think that's what I'm doing a lot of the time.
Hmm.
And I think that's why, a long time ago, Peter Pilates, author of Down the Hume, told me, you know, like, I think what you've got to try and do is write something that isn't full of jokes. And
He can talk.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was absurd because, you know, his writing's hysterical.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, I think a lot of people miss that in Down the Hume. Missed how funny it is because it's also so dark.
Yeah, yeah. People have said that to me about his work, that they find it cruel. Like they find it really vicious. But I think it... I don't...
Oh, but it's also... It's funny, though.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's funny. It's And I think that's a really hard thing is... I think... It always surprises me how bad... some readers are, you know, serious readers are detecting irony. And
I got to say, it's one of my weaknesses.
Is that right?
Yeah, often don't get irony the first time around. Really? I just take people at face value.
Well, that's you people are out there.
Yeah. But I've trained myself. You know, the more you read, the better you get at it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But if you can get yourself in a whole lot of trouble real quick if you're being ironic and nobody knows.
What could you possibly be referring to, Luke?
Yeah, well, you know, it's mentioned in the beginning of that Northern Rivers essay. But, you know, ages ago, I was sitting around at the Bankstown office and editor of Sydney Review Books comes out and is like, well, we need someone to do the guest editorial, 500 words. You want to write something about festivals? Yeah, no worries. And so I wrote it up, you know, in a couple of minutes, sent it, and then didn't think another thing of it. And then next thing you know, people are contacting me, what the fuck have you done? Why did you do this? You know, why did you shit on everybody's festivals and, you know, what's your problem? And I was like, what? It was very, very weird to me. So it was, you know, it seems like a cop-out to say that, I was just being ironic. Leave me alone.
Yeah.
And because, you know, I think when you're being ironic, it's not necessarily that you don't mean...
Yeah.
What you're saying is just you don't necessarily mean it to the extent that you're expressing in print. And, you know, but I can't help that. My natural inclination in some ways is, you know, I wouldn't be able to write if I couldn't exaggerate.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's a line in Thomas Bernhard where he says, the only justification for life is exaggeration. And, it's true for me. I just, when I start writing, I can't help but take my, whatever I happen to be, like, write what you think, write what you imagine, write what might be, not exactly what you know things to be. That's the way I work. And you know, there's got to be room for that in...
Yeah.
In literature, there's got to, you know, just in day-to-day life, there's got to be room for people who aren't sensible, you know. And I know I'm not a sensible person. I'm not a coherent person. I'm not concise, if you like. I don't know what I think.
Yeah.
Most of the time. And so when I'm writing, I've got to take those risks or I wouldn't be able to start. I wouldn't be able to get going. My first Mananian encounter was of a humiliatingly Blumian stripe. On a visit to my editor's office to discuss a second draft of what was then a slip of manuscript, I was offered a long list of novels the editor felt it was in my interest to investigate. When the question of which Manains I had read was raised, I confessed not only to have never read a word Manane had written, but had, in fact, never heard his name before. To this, my editor recoiled as if I'd hocked a golly in his direction. Manane, my editor informed me, was not only a major author in Australian letters, despite what is often referred to as his lack of wider recognition, but more to the point, was one of the brightest stars in my editor's stable, and as such, my editor had every right to take my inattentiveness to this important writer as a personal and embarrassing failure on both our accounts. Immediately, I was led to a room down the hall where my editor's vast stock of books were kept, and five titles, the latest of which was Barley Patch, were pressed into my hands. "You'll like these," my editor announced in a voice as ominous as prophecy. Despite the weight of this exchange, by the time I got around to reading Barley Patch, the years had run like rabbits, and now not only was my own short manuscript a published novel, but Manane too had brought out two further publications. Unsurprisingly, then, when I came knocking on the office door, declaring to my editor that I'd read the first pages of Barley Patch and had come to discuss the wonders I encountered there, the look on his face expressed perplexed wonder at what it was he'd done to deserve such unsolicited and unintelligible harassment. I cannot now recall what it was I said that morning to my editor, who showed nothing but impassive patience with my claim to have discovered a kind of mental doppelganger in the pages of Gerald's work. But I made clear that this Manane fellow, whoever he was, had written in Barley Patch not merely a facsimile of the thought being I believed myself one day might be. He had, in his eccentric modes and bold assertions of style, shown me the way by which I would become the writing entity I dreamed one day to be. Encounters of this kind are, I understood even at the time, not unknown amongst writers and readers of fiction. And I considered past discoveries of influence in Kerouac, Whitman, Bernhardt, and Salinger to have been approximate to this experience, but it had always been a notion of style that had caused me this feeling of false proximity. In the case of Manane, the uncanniness went beyond style or voice. There seemed to me a form of thinking so closely resembling my own in those opening sentences of Barley Patch that I could imagine no means by which to separate what was printed on the page from what I thought, felt, and hoped to be. However I might have expected my editor to respond to this report of reading myself in the work of a master writer, I can see now that I should have anticipated how repulsive such a claim might sound. My editor rose from behind his desk, shaking his silver-haired head with an incredulity, ushering me out the door saying, No. My name's nothing like you at all. And when we were out in the hall, my editor placed a hand on my shoulder and said with a tone of panic, "No, Manane's what you might call a monastic writer, you know. He's nothing like, his writing's nothing like yours. You're more of a social type, you know, more focused on awkward encounters and strange interactions and the like." It took me some time to register this reading, and the hallway was very narrow, but my editor went on guiding me away from his office. "Listen, I'll tell you the secret of Manane's writing, so you understand what I mean. The secret is resonance and recursion." At this point, smooth as a magician, my editor reached down to snatch up a copy of A Million Windows, which was by then the latest of Manane's books to be printed. copies of which happened to be stacked on a desk just behind the hall. "Look here," the editor said, pointing to an image of a lit window inside a large house on the front cover of the book. "In this work, there's a section where the narrator describes a house of two or three stories with the setting sun reflecting in a window like drops of golden oil. But the work itself is being written by the narrator in the fiction of the book, and the house is a work of fiction in the fictional world of the narrator's mind." Now, that image of golden drops in the window is presented in such a way by this narrator, by a narrator remembering an image of a window lit like hot oil, that by the time the reader has read it, the image is overlain in their mind, refracted like an image bouncing between mirrors, and it is as if they have seen it again and again, a forced persistence of memory, and so they see it blaze in their mental landscape, the golden oil, like a dream lantern of their own inner life. With that, my editor thrust the book into my hands and rushed back into his office, and this time shut the door.
On the point of non-concision, might be a good time to talk about Manane. Okay. There's a line from, I think it's from Barley Patch, that I always think of with Manane, where he's talking about, I think I've mentioned this to you before, he's talking about a picnic lunch or something. No, I don't know if it's a picnic lunch, but lunch with his mum and his auntie, and he refers to a dish of chopped lettuce and cold vegetables that is commonly referred to as salad.
Yeah.
Concision is not the thing.
No, and that's what I think I loved. That's one of the things that I felt that Gerald Manane gifted to me when I first encountered his writing. And I don't, there's a hell of a lot of gulf between my writing and Gerald Manane. So I don't mean to suggest that I think I write like Gerald Manane, but when I read his writing, I see the things that I want to do, and he does them in a way I think far out. The balls on this guy to do it this way. When I picked up Invisible Yet Enduring Lilacs.
I love that book.
It's an amazing book. And say you turn to his essay on Kerouac and you get about halfway through, I may be overblowing it, but you get about halfway through before he even mentions Kerouac. And when he does, he focuses on Kerouac's marble racing when he was a kid. It's like that's the thing that mattered to Manane, so that's what he talked about.
Yeah.
He didn't try to even it out. He didn't try to make it balanced and sensible. I don't think that even crossed his mind. He just, what he was drawn to write, what spoke to him, and he, he's very articulate about that and insistent about working that way. That's the way he did it. No compromise at all, it seems to me.
But I love those sorts of essays where it's like, this is something that's probably being written about a lot, but this is my way into it.
Absolutely.
This is my specific attachment to this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had the great good fortune to get invited recently to a conference out at Groke to meet Gerald Manane, who gave a paper, and to be a participant in the conference itself out at Groke Golf Club.
Amazing.
It was it was incredible. And so you got to get out there to start with. So you got to pass through the terrain, which Manane writes about, the plains, and it's incredible. And I thought, it's a long way out. It'll be the conference itself that is the audience. But I get out there, and the maximum capacity for the Garoque Golf Club was 50 people. So there was 50 people there, and they were all Manane-ophiles. They were absolute fanatics, and I didn't realize it was terrifying because I'm not a a Gerald Benane expert by any means. Yeah. I've read a couple of his books and some of his essays.
But what I love about that piece, though, is what you're describing is what I think of as, like, the reason why we read, right? Like, every now and again you come across something that reflects yourself back to you.
Yeah.
And there's such solace in that. And it's electrifying.
Absolutely. And, with Manane, that's one of the number one pleasures of reading him is, in contrast to what we were talking about before about movement and travel and so on, one of the things about Manane is that you recognize parts of yourself that you didn't even know you had in his work, or you re-recognize, or you remember it or something.
Yeah.
And particularly about the process of writing, writing and reading, what they are. Because I remember, in his work, he talks about, sort of becoming immersed in books and self-inserting into the stories and so on. And that's what I did when I was a kid and I read. I was always, in a sense, almost like fan fiction. I was participating in the novels that I was reading, And
I used to, when I was a kid, have these elaborate fantasy worlds that I'd take, when I was trying to go to sleep, mostly, from that book, and I'd kind of either continue the story or rework the story with also a Fiona character in there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes, I did. Right. Absolutely. And that's, Manane talks about that quite a lot in the books that I've read.
Specific one, I think it might be Barley Patch, where he's writing about the magazine.
Barley Patch.
Yeah.
Yeah. It could be in others, but it's definitely in Barley Patch. And I used to, when I was a kid, I read voraciously because I was an insomniac, and that was the only thing I could do to sort of resist it, but to counter its effects. But the only books we had in the house were my stepfather's, and they were all fantasy.
Yeah, right.
They were all fantasy, and so I used to. And I remember I got really caught up in this one series, and I cannot for the life of me remember what it was called. But it was a typical fantasy series. You know, had like 14 books, and I was reading through it, and most of it, from what I remember, was this group of people wandering through the woods and the cooking potatoes in around a campfire or whatever, skinning rabbits and eating rabbits and stuff.
Lord of the Rings.
Exactly. They were all Lord of the Rings, all shitty versions of shittier versions of Lord of the Rings. And, I remember that there was a wizard and his wife, who was a sorceress.
Correct.
And they would bicker constantly. It used to drive me crazy. And I used to, what I would do is insert myself into the stories in my fantasies, you're saying, I'd put the book down for a second, I'd start imagining that I walked into the forest and I'd get them to stop fighting. Stop fighting, you two. You're at war. It's the end of the war. There's dragons fucking attacking everyone. Stop bickering. Stop it. And then, of course, I was a kid from a broken home, and, I was trying to repair their relationship in my fantasies. And then at some point, I didn't think of that at all when I was a kid, but that's what I used to fantasize about. And then at some point, the author of the series revealed that he'd written the books with his wife. All of them were actually secretly co-written, and that she had written the wife's role. And I remember, I don't know why, but I felt absolutely betrayed by that. And I was like, what? That's why all this bickering was going on? Because you two were
having this elaborate in-joke.
Yeah. I couldn't believe you put me through hell. But you guys thought it was cute. And I hated it. And I think I stopped reading fantasy as soon as I found out that guy and his wife wrote this book. But anyway, that's a long... I don't know why I bring it up, but I love that Manane makes you remember those sorts of things. And I think that's why in his latest book, he's also, for me, it's a reminder about why, they say it's probably his last, I know he doesn't call these books novels, but it's probably his last, probably his last book, other than old stuff that will be coming out again, I think. And I know it wasn't the last one he actually wrote, it just happened to come out last, but it starts off talking about this concept of guarding the eye. They mentioned it in most of the reviews. And at the conference, Emmett's, that I went to, Emmett Stinson pointed out that it's it's kind of a reworking of the beginning of the plains. Mm. The beginning of border districts, the latest one, is kind of a reworking of the beginning of the plains. Instead of eyes wide open, it's guarding your eyes. And the concept of guarding your eyes is, not that you can learn about things more by leaving them in the periphery than by looking at them directly.
That's interesting.
It is interesting. Yeah. And he literally does that. And as Manane calls himself, the real Manane, the breathing author, also doesn't do that. So, he'll drive, there's a certain church that he wants to write about or that he has written about, and he doesn't look at it directly. He drives past and refuses to make direct eye contact, so to speak, with the building, in order to keep the image and the whatever grammar that image suggests pure.
Hmm.
And I don't know if pure is the right word, but it's something that. And he talks about that being the idea of the writer is, what presents itself or what summons you, what calls you, what heralds you in the external world is important and is your, that's your reason for being as a writer. That's what that's where your focus as a writer should be. I'm not articulating it very well, but you know what I mean?
It's really
the world will call to you and you must respond to that.
Your vocation calls and you answer it.
Exactly. and that for me was a good first principle, a reminder of first principles as to being a writer. You get into it because I think in some, at least in the my case, and from what you've told me in the past, it is probably similar for you, is that, certain... I suppose it's kind of like the idea of the German romanticism, the blue rose,
the
dream of the thing that is so, the image of the thing which is so resonant that you must capture it in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
Or
it won't let itself be put down. It just buzzes around in the back of your brain.
Yeah, absolutely. I always think of... an interview with Leonard Cohen where he talked about he became a poet when his father died. He was very young and they came back from the funeral and he went out in the backyard and wrote down something, he can't remember what, on a scrap of paper and went upstairs and inserted it into the collar of his father's jacket. And his father was a tailor, and he can't remember what it was or why he did that, but that was the only way he could deal with the intensity of his situation.
Wow, what an image.
It's a great image.
Yeah.
I think that's that to me is where Manane's border districts is reminding. That's what it reminds me of in any case. Right. It's a really interesting book, and he's a wonderful writer. And it was amazing to go to the conference and to be there with him. And it was totally surreal. We walked in and Joe Manet's standing there, and people are walking up to him. The presenters are the first people in, and I remember one of the presenters. She goes over and she says, "Hello, Manane." And then immediately corrects herself and says, "Oh, I shouldn't call you Manane, and it became immediately like she's
that's
been
just how I write about
him. Yeah, that's what she's been calling him.
Yeah.
For years, and she just couldn't help but blurt it out to him, it was such a Mananean thing. The breathing author is being assailed. But it was, before he spoke, he had written an announcement. Which Anthony Ullman, who was in charge of the conference, read out, and it was, "Gerald Manane would like me to read a brief announcement. Gerald Manane will be available for some of the talks, but he does not feel obliged to stay for all of them. He would like to inform you that he will be available to serve drinks at the bar until midnight tonight or at a time at which most people have left the building." Something like
that.
Just so weird, and you know, really interesting. And then he, you know, between the presenters, Gerald Benane stood behind the bar and served everybody beers and signed books. It was just so weird.
I'll have a beer and a book, thanks.
Yeah.
That's so good.
It was really interesting. And it was amazing to see how many people there were fanatical about him.
Yeah.
You know, he has real, really strong following.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I wanted to ask you, finally, about what you're working on at the moment. I know you're writing essays.
Yep. There's an essay that I've written two essays on the subject of Gerald Benane accidentally, and they've got to come out soon or else I'll be crucified. But there's another essay that I've...
You'll be crucified?
I will be.
Oh.
Because they're overdue.
Overdue. Because you've smashed your deadline
in the wrong direction. But there is another deadline which I'm even further behind. There's a deadline. I missed my deadline now on this particular essay that I'm writing by nearly 2 years. And every 6 months, the editor writes to me and says, hey, you know, you still, how's that going? And I live in fear, you know, and I write back, you know, grovelingly, oh, thank you for not losing hope. It's coming. But I don't know what the hell is wrong. It's so hard to write. And I think it's possibly to do with the subject matter, but what I'd like to write about is, to be really crude about it, is mental illness. And I'd like that to be one of the central themes of what I'm putting together next, which is a collection of essays, because I had a really intense experience of being mentally unsound a year or two ago, and I'm still sort of putting everything back together.
Yeah.
And so I have to write about it because I cannot clear the fog any other way. Yeah. It's the only way I know how to deal with anything is to write about it. So I've got to do that. And it's been really difficult.
It's not an easy thing to do.
No.
Yeah, because you've got to be brutal and you've got to be honest or you can, like, smell it a mile off.
Yeah, and that's been...
And I know in my experience sometimes writing an essay about something with a lot of emotion attached to it dredges all that back up again for you.
Yeah.
So have fun with that.
That's right. I don't know if it was similar for you, but you know, writing about the, you know, really intimate vulnerabilities, it's not as if I'm uncomfortable doing it, or sort of, it's not as if I sit there weeping at the page, but you know, it makes you. It ruins your day.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, that took all my emotional energy went into that, and now I'm fucked.
Because you're sitting there poking at your own sore bits.
Yeah.
And you go, oh shit, that still hurts a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, and even now as I'm doing it, I'm thinking, oh no, it's a really tricky. You know, you can't be self. You don't want to be self pitying about it. You don't want to bullshit about it. You don't. And I'm not really even sure why I'm doing it. It's just
because you need to.
Yeah, it's just necessary. That's right. And so I don't even know if it's a good idea, whatever that means. But it's what I've got to do. And if I get it done, I will feel like I've, you know, thrown off a huge weight.
Yeah.
So I've got to get it done. And the fact, you know, it's 2 years overdue, and so for 2 years, just like back in the doctoral thesis days, I'm bent backed. You know, like, I just feel like, ugh. I don't know how to, what's that feeling when you've got, you know, your exegesis is hovering over your entire life. You feel sort of,
I don't know. I cope with deadlines in the opposite way. I get so freaked out that, like, I'm like, I've got to get this done. I've got to get it done now.
That's right. You finish your thesis in like 3 years. took me a decade. God damn it. You know, procrastination, it's just, I don't even know if that's the word for after a certain point, you know. But I don't know. That's where I'm at. And it's interesting. And I don't know whether I would have even attempted it if it wasn't for your collection, oh, actually.
Thank you. That's really lovely.
Oh, no, it's true. I thought that was, you know, an extraordinary thing, the small acts of disappearance.
But, and, you know, everything you said, though, about being driven to do that, I've related to 100%. Like, I sort of, it was my way of dealing with these kind of huge shifts, this kind of experience that you come through and has changed everything that's gone before it, and you kind of got all these pieces up in the air, and it was my way of, you know, figuring out where they'd land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how long did it take you to...
4 years.
Okay. All right.
Look at your face, you're like, yeah, I can do this.
Yeah. 4 years, okay.
Oh, that's so funny. All right, well, I reckon that's a good note to end on, okay. Which seems to be what I say every single time I'm winding one of these things up.
That's good. It works.
Yeah, but thanks so much for talking to me, Luke. And for,
it's
been fascinating.
Thank you.
Is supported by the Crown Packer Foundation, the Sydney Review of Books, and the Writing and Society Research Centre at Western Sydney University. Our theme music is by Phil Fadul, and production assistance is by Ben Denham. Thank you for listening, and see you again soon.